Hello, six pack of confidence. Been so many nights since we first met. Glad to see you brought all your friends for another night of Plastic Cup Politics.
Hey, how's it going, everybody? Welcome to a very belated episode of Plastic Cup Politics podcast. Yeah, you know, sometimes life comes at you pretty fast, and you got to do things to take care of that, like, you know, fantasy football and stuff like that. You know, the important things in life get in the way. This is Plastic Cup Politics podcast, Arizona-based drinking and politics podcast. I'm your host, Mark LaRue. He is Dr. Sean Hayes, PhD. He has his degree in political science, but is currently working as an information securities engineer for the finance and travel industry. You can interact with the show at Plastic Cup Pod and all your favorite social media sites. And we can just go ahead and get right on into this because we took some time off. And so now we have a lot to get to, but I'm going to narrow it down to, we have a game plan at least. We got some little bit of Gosser news. Guess what? I know it's going to be a big shocker, but there's been more mass shootings, more mass casualty gun events. There's been more regulations on immigration, only this time on legal immigration. And then, you know, we need to figure out what is going on with Brexit. Sound good to you?
Yeah, that sounds awesome. But before we get into any of that, did you just say mass casualty gun event? Is that what we're calling it now?
I was trying it out.
Man, that is some fucking 1984 newspeak right there, dude.
Yeah.
Mass casualty gun event. And I'm not even sure which side that would be brainwashing you for. Because if you think about it, really, it puts the responsibility for the act squarely on the gun, because it's a mass casualty gun event. But then again, there's also no positive action in the statement. It is a gun event, not the gun did something or someone did something with a gun. It's a gun event at which there were mass casualties. It makes it sound like somebody blew up a gun show.
Well, the way I've been using it is when I'm arguing with people online, because I don't want to use mass shootings, because then they're like, well, you know, the gun, like, okay, how about instead of saying, you know, it's just crazy people with guns, let's just call them events where a lot of people died, where there also happen to be guns.
But wait a minute. What is their response to mass shootings? What's the objection to... Is that not what's happening?
Yes, but their thing would be that, you know, if they didn't have a gun... Yeah, I saw this meme recently talking about Timothy McVeigh and about how many people that he killed and about how you can still get fertilizer and about how you can still get racing fuel. And my only thought was, if there were mass casualty events that all involved box trucks and fertilizer bombs, I think that there would be a much more restrictions at U-Haul.
Oh, and hey, guess what? After that event in 1994, that's when Timothy McVeigh murdered 116, I think, innocent men, women, and children. There was a daycare in the building that he blew up. And he did so because he was a religious bigot and a white supremacist. So after he did that, you know what the ATF started tracking really closely? And what you have to sign a lot of papers to get? Large volumes of ammonium nitrate and racing fuel. You know what the ATF is by law not allowed to keep computerized records of? Gun sales.
Yeah, and we'll get into that pretty quick, I'm assuming, after we discuss what we're partaking of.
Oh.
What are you doing, man? What are you having?
I am having myself, although I'm pretty much at the point now where I could have a beer for the show if I wanted to, but I still have plenty of this Baked Bros syrup left, and so I'm just trying different varieties. This time, instead of doing the seed lip, I went with a really high-end tonic with a high quinine level. Right, but lower sugar content. So the quinine is overpowering the sugar from the Baked Bros syrup, so it tastes more thoroughly like a G&T. It lacks a little bit of that, what I talked about last time, the hoof, you know, that weird breathiness that you get from gin that the seed lip kind of produces.
Yeah.
but it feels a little more accurately like a gin and tonic experience this way.
Do you know how gin and tonics allowed the conquest of India, allegedly?
Yes, because quinine prevents infection by malaria, or prevents the malaria infection, which is acquired via mosquito bite. It's not even allegedly. Well, it is not the factor that allowed them to conquer India, but part of what allowed the British Empire to operate so effectively in the tropics for a great many years was their fondness for gin and tonic. Quinine is the primary treatment for malaria. And quinine is one of the ingredients of tonic, not seltzer or soda water, but specifically tonic. The other cool thing is, do you know why the British are sometimes called limeys?
No.
So they were one of the first navies to discover that the cause of scurvy was vitamin C deficiency. And so they began stocking their long-haul ships with barrels of limes, which kept better than lemons or oranges because they have a lower sugar content and a lower water content overall. And each sailor would get, you know, a lime a day or a lime a week. I forget exactly what the ration was. I suppose it probably depended on the length of the voyage, really. But it's ultimately why they were able to sail such long distances without having their hair and teeth fall out, which is what typically happens with scurvy before you begin to experience organ failure and die. But as a result, they acquired the sometimes not so fond nickname of limey. I wouldn't recommend referring to your English friends as limeys, by the way. It's probably not a great idea.
Is it pejorative?
It is. It is pretty pejorative. Although, when you think about it, like, no real reason that should be pejorative. It's a pretty smart goddamn thing to have figured out, right? Now, chances are they probably, like, observed it in one of the, you know, one of the cultures they conquered in... in Southeast Asia or some other part of the world and just took the practice from them. But either way, like, I don't understand why referring to someone as, hey, you're one of those people that doesn't get scurvy when you're on a ship. You suck. All right.
So be it. I am having a wonderful barrel-aged stout from some call me Tim Brewing or...
Yeah,
our guy Tim's Brewing, and it is very good.
Nice.
It's nice and woody for a homebrewed barrel aged stout.
What kind of wood?
I believe it was whiskey barrel, so oak.
Nice,
but it's. I mean, for anyone, it is really is very good. So we can talk about things that are very good. But first, we're going to talk about...
I'm feeling a little professorial. And I was having a conversation with a friend the other day, and I tried to explain this concept, and I think I mucked it up. And that friend listens to the podcast, so I'd like to clarify now. The phrase... Are you familiar with the phrase, beyond the pale?
I know the phrase.
Okay. So, and it's pale, P-A-L-E, not P-A-I-L. Right, and that's an important distinction. So the word pale derives from the Roman palus or palius, which refers to a stake, right? And they would form pale fences, stake fences, so basically rough-hewn stick fences, to border off areas. And at some point... and this is mostly in the, I think this development occurred mostly in the Roman provinces in what is now the United Kingdom, so England and Ireland. The idea began, they began using pales to define roadways, right? And eventually it became sort of accepted knowledge that if you went beyond the pale, you deviated from the roadway, you would be set upon by brigands, Right, and there was even a sort of a wives' tale that started going around about a family that gets set upon by brigands because they go beyond the pale. Now, that probably wouldn't have been enough for it to stick as a phrase. Where it really gets its teeth is in Ireland. So in Ireland, the English invaded that country repeatedly, and every time they did, they would get to a certain river, which has a different name in Gaelic, but they began to refer to it as the Pale, because it formed the northwest boundary of the area the English were able to successfully conquer. Even William of Orange couldn't successfully go beyond the Pale. Beyond the Pale was where savages lived, and units of English military that went beyond the Pale never came back. Just like the people who went beyond the Pale on those roadways in ancient England and were set upon by brigands and never came back. So the idea is, inside the Pale, things are ordinary and safe. Beyond the Pale lies the strange and the dangerous. But it gets its origin ultimately, primarily from the depredations of the English against the Irish.
So we could call the North Wall the Ice Wall, the Pale, because past it was the wildlings, and nobody ever came back.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, what's up, Game of Thrones?
Yeah,
I guess we miss you. Okay.
sort of, I guess, yeah.
Speaking of things that were a big deal, but aren't a big deal anymore, like Game of Thrones. Hey, man, we haven't recorded in a while. You remember back like 6 7 days ago when the Amazon was on fire
Yeah, that's a good one,
and
right?
people cared about that?
Yeah, so there are still some people out there who care about it, but they have missed the best part of this story. I can almost guarantee it. So you have to go back a little bit to, it was right around the same time that Dump got elected, there was a far right-wing government in Italy that was elected. That government, by the way, is now gone. They folded last week. Brazil elected a far, far right-wing president named Jair Bolsonaro. And
Military guy, right?
actually, I don't know that he's ever served. He sure kisses a lot of military ass, but I'm not sure he ever actually served in the military. We would need to look that up, which I'm going to pause now to do.
Or a militaristic,
Well, he is certainly militaristic, but what
a
he is
military
mostly,
rule.
yes, but what he is mostly is a racist, a homophobe, and a dyed-in-the-wool fascist, right? A sort of industrial fascist along the mode of Mussolini. And one of the things that Jair Bolsonaro campaigned on was essentially the destruction of the Amazon. He said he would gladly burn it all to the ground and develop it so that his country could be more successful economically. Now, the Amazon is on fire, primarily because soybean farmers in Brazil keep lighting the outskirts of the Amazon on fire to generate new land. Interestingly enough, there's a tie-in to President Dump's trade war. Right? Because the Chinese used to buy most of their soybean for pig feed from us. They don't anymore. So now Brazilian farmers are lighting the Amazon on fire to create additional farmland to grow soybeans to feed Chinese pigs because President Trump has tiny balls.
I would like to go a different direction from that, which is to tie this in to everybody's favorite Paul Gosar and about how he's always all over Facebook talking about how they're ending these regulations so that we can mine the Grand Canyon and get all the uranium and all these environmental regulations that have been put into place, which is basically what Bolsonaro ran on. And you know what? I know the end game of that is a whole lot of fires in the Amazon, even though I've heard that. Guess what? They said it's a slash and burn kind of a culture where they do this on a yearly basis. It's just massive
Yes,
this year.
so that line of argument right there is disingenuous.
Okay.
So there are certain tribal cultures in the Amazon that slash and burn, but they will move to a new field in the following year, right? Because the topsoil is very thin in the Amazon, right? And you sort of have to burn it to add nutrients to that soil to make it viable. But once you've grown on it for one or two seasons, it sucks again and you've got to move on. So those tribal cultures, yes, they would slash and burn acreage, grow food on it, move to a new one, and the old one would start to regrow Amazon forest. That's not what's happening in Brazil. To say that industrial soybean farmers in Brazil are practicing a cultural form of slash and burn agriculture is nonsense, because they're not moving to new fields. They are enriching those fields with chemical fertilizers year after year so that they can continue to grow soybeans on them. These are two completely separate things. And for a long time, environmental crusaders in the Amazon actually did get a bad reputation for trying to prevent tribal cultures in the Amazon from continuing to practice agricultural practices that they had practiced for centuries. Right? And rightfully so, they deserved that bad rap. But Jair Bolsonaro and his supporters are trying to use that old animosity as a shield for these industrial agriculture operations. These are not small-time indigenous operators we're talking about.
And yeah, I guess that I completely understand what you're saying, because now that I'm thinking about it, I'm like, yeah, I don't think that even when I was on the Murdy Mile in Parsons, Kansas, which is a great aunt and uncle's farm, that yeah, nobody's really doing slash and burn anymore, and they're a pretty small farm, and I guess that when they're trying to grow soybeans on massive farms, they probably have moved on to the same techniques that we have. This yep. is the weird thing that I have to grasp with in myself a lot, is when I think of these other countries, and I just assume that they don't have the same things that we do and the same technology, and that, like, oh, it's crazy. You can fly into Calcutta. Like, they have airplanes there.
Yep. You want to know something even, well, I don't know whether it's sadder or funnier or what, but those Brazilian farmers are locked into contracts with the same seed suppliers that American farmers are. So Monsanto primarily. And by and large, their farms are actually owned and operated by the same industrial multinational conglomerates that own and operate the farms here in the Midwest.
That's what I was figuring.
So it's all a scam, right? To talk about these as if they're small-time little Brazilian farmers who are being trampled upon by, cultural crusaders from the West, which is how Bolsonaro tries to frame this, is complete bullshit. It's the same way that it's complete bullshit when the Republican Party tries to sell us on eliminating the estate tax by claiming that it's going to destroy the family farm. They have yet to find a single family farm that has ever been taxed under the estate tax. Not one.
It kind of seems to me like Bolsonaro is like if Donald Trump didn't have anything holding him back. Like, I could see these kind of regulations, and that's kind of what they're saying about Bolsonaro, is that he's letting these fires go. Like, he is trying, as you said, wants to make the Amazon no longer the lungs of the world, but an economic force. And which is a weird question on how can we say that we all need this air all around this planet, but you can't do what you want to do within your own country.
Yeah, that's a tough one, right? Now you're getting into questions of ethics, intergenerational justice, national sovereignty, and a lot of these are approaching the verge of what we would refer to as a wicked problem, right? And a wicked problem typically refers to anything that has to be resolved by virtue of politics. And more importantly, it's the kind of problem that's resolved via politics but has a profusion of competing loyalties. It's the kind of problem that gets stuck indefinitely. So, for example, for a long time, fisheries, especially the fisheries off the Atlantic coast of the United States, were referred to as a wicked problem, right? Because they are a resource held in common, it's very difficult to police that resource centrally by the state. But the individual actors involved in exploiting that resource couldn't be counted upon to act ethically. Why? For the simple reasons the game theory has demonstrated repeatedly over and over. It's that there is a combination of self-interest and suspicion that will lead you to always assume that someone else is going to defect, right? That someone else is going to overfish, and you're going to end up losing out if you don't overfish too. So everybody has a race to overfish as much as they possibly can to make as much money as they can in the short term, so that when the fishery eventually dries up...
they've ridden the wave the farthest?
Yeah. There's a whole lot of... We're deploying a whole lot of nautical metaphors there. the same issue could be said of the Amazon in Brazil. Now, we know that at this point, the amount, the degree to which the Amazon supplies the globe with oxygen has actually been largely overblown. Most of the CO2 absorption and oxygen production actually takes place in the ocean. But it is still an important resource, an important global resource for a lot of reasons. I just think it's more important to discuss it in those terms than to talk about it in terms of, like you had mentioned before, the lungs of the planet,
mm-hmm.
right? Because that's the same sort of terminology that those environmental crusaders in the 90s got in trouble for, right? It's the kind of hyperbole that when you get called out on it, tarnishes an entire movement. Now, the Amazon is an irreplaceable resource in terms of biodiversity, which in and of itself is crucial to the global ecosystem. All right. It is also an irreplaceable resource in terms of potential new medicines and treatments, which are discovered there all the time by bioprospecting companies. It is an invaluable resource in terms of ecotourism for Brazil, an industry that Jair Bolsonaro is actively trying to kill. And generally speaking, now to a lesser extent than the oceans, but still an important extent, it also provides the world with a lot of oxygen and absorbs a lot of CO2. So it is a critical resource to mankind globally, and it is currently under almost the exclusive control of a madman who wants to burn it to the ground. So yeah, other governments around the globe reacted very strongly. Public sentiment was very, very strong, and so he backed down and deployed his military to try and stop the fires. He then went begging, because Brazil doesn't have a whole lot of money, and the leaders of the G7, the group of seven nations, the seven most powerful economic countries, the seven most powerful economies in the world, the exception of a couple of notable bad actors, they decided, apart from the United States, because Donald Trump wouldn't participate, he's a big fucking baby and wouldn't participate in any conversations that involved the environment, they pledged $24 million to help fund that operation to contain the wildfires. But because the president of France, President Emmanuel Macron, wouldn't kiss Jair Bolsonaro's ass, and in fact said that this was his fault,
he decided that beggars really could be choosers.
Yeah, he turned the money down until the president of France took back his insulting comments. That's like the guy on the street with his hand out, right, trying to beg money for his next bindle of dope, turns to you and says, "Hey, look, if you're gonna be uppity about it, I don't want your money. When you're ready to come back here and be respectful to me, then I'll take your charity." All right, dude. The rest of the world is just sort of bemusedly shaking their head at what a fucking dumbass you are.
Yeah, really. I was only giving you the money, hoping that your dog would get some food. Now you're gonna hold it against your fucking dog.
Yeah.
That was not a really good reference. I was not calling the people of Brazil dogs.
No, it's just sure a very common situation here in the Valley in particular, where we will end up donating money to homeless folks primarily to take care of their dogs.
AKA Meals on Wheels.
Oh, dude, don't say that, man.
Moving on!
It just bums me out.
We even took a couple weeks off, and still the last two episodes involved mass shootings. Is that better? This one was a guy taken, also in Texas, third one in Texas this month, a guy taking pot shots while driving around, so taking it back to the 80s with the drive-by. This one was not a weapon that had gone through a background check. They know that it was bought through a private sale.
Oh, and Greg Abbott just fucking busted a nut over that one, dude. We've got to keep these guns out of the hands of criminals. He still bought it legally, Jack Wagon.
Yeah,
he just didn't buy it through a licensed federal firearms dealer. He bought it in a private sale, which is what we've been talking about with the fucking gun show and private sale loophole.
Yeah, you want to know how many background checks I've passed?
I'm going to guess two.
I really... three.
Yeah.
Yeah, three. Yeah, you don't... If you have friends with guns, you don't have to go through background checks.
Nope.
I mean,
and again, we do background checks for the purchase of ammonium nitrate. So let that sink in. No background checks to buy a gun, but you got to do a background. You've got to provide documentation in order to buy some fucking fertilizer.
And Sudafed.
Oh, yeah, that's another great one. That's an even better goddamn example. I have to give my license over to buy a fucking decongestant. The state knows every time I have bought Claritin D for the last 10 years. But they don't know that I own a handgun. Well, they do now, but they didn't before.
This leads me directly into a listener question. They want to know with everything that's going on in Hong Kong. As a matter of fact, if you want to do us a favor and catch us up on anything that's going on in Hong Kong, I know that the protests got kind of bad, and then they got nice and they're peaceful again, but they keep going on. But the question was, do you think that the situation would be different if Hong Kong had an armed populace?
No. Not even a little bit. Look, if we were talking about, you know, some podunk hillbilly military that was going to show up in jeeps and fucking old World War One surplus British rifles or some shit, then yeah, maybe an armed populace would help. But we're talking about the second most sophisticated military on Earth. You can have all the AK-47s you want, and it doesn't matter when the Chinese government has drones. They don't need to come anywhere near you. They put it in a pylon turn at 10,000 feet and rain the Chinese equivalent of Hellfire missiles down on you all fucking day. Right? They flood Hong Kong with boots. They kill everyone who resists. And they break the pseudo-democracy, the pseudo-self-governance of Hong Kong. All right, that's where this ends up if there's an armed citizenry. In fact, one of the only reasons that the citizens of Hong Kong are not currently squirming under the heel of a Chinese jackboot is because they are not armed. An armed citizenry would have given China exactly the pretext they needed to invade Hong Kong. Because then you're not dealing with protesters, you're dealing with an insurgency. And the world responds very differently to putting down an insurgency than they do to butchering protesters in the street.
That's why you always feel bad for the guy throwing the rock.
Exactly. That answer should come as no surprise to our listeners if they've ever heard me talk about what I believe the prospects of an armed citizenry would be in resisting the government of the United States. Look, the videos there aren't new ones really popping up anymore, but a lot of the ones from the WikiLeaks dump are still out there. Just Google A10, or not A10, well, fuck, Google A10, there's a good one for you, but Google C-130, C-130 gunship. Pull up those videos and watch what happens to all those dudes armed with AK-47s on the ground when a 144-millimeter cannon opens up on them, or a 40-millimeter Bofors, or they open up with the 25-millimeter Gauss, the dual ones up towards the front of the plane. Everybody dies. Occasionally, you'll even see little flashes as they're shooting up at the plane. Right? And the people on the plane are laughing their asses off as everybody dies.
Except for the ones on the plane.
So, no. Unarmed citizenry wouldn't have changed anything except to have turned this into an invasion much sooner. The things that are keeping China from invading Hong Kong are twofold. One is everyone remembers Tiananmen Square. And those people who are too young to remember Tiananmen Square, they have been reminded of it repeatedly in recent weeks as the image of the tank man, basically a lone Chinese man who happened to be walking home from the grocery store. The objects in his hands, when you watch that video, they're grocery bags with canned goods in them. He wanders into Tiananmen Square, immediately joins the protest, and stands in front of a tank and refuses to move. He faces down a line of Chinese tanks. Shortly thereafter, the Chinese government moved in and began butchering people. The international response to what the Chinese did after Tiananmen Square was so virulent that the Chinese government to this day is afraid to become too vigorous in responding to protests because of it. The second thing is related. So the Chinese government has a policy of what they refer to as One China, right? They want Hong Kong brought back into the fold without its special sovereignty. And they want is for Taiwan to renounce its local government and acknowledge that it is still and always has been a part of mainland China. The Taiwanese absolutely don't want to do that. We just sold them a new shipment of F-16s, which greatly angered the Chinese government. So what China sees is, so they've been trying to talk to the Taiwanese and basically say, hey, look, if you come back into the fold, nothing bad is going to happen to you. You'll still have your stock, but you'll have essentially what Hong Kong has. We'll make the same deal that we gave Hong Kong. If China now goes in and tramples the protests in Hong Kong, the Taiwanese go, well, why the fuck would we want that?
Right. So that's how it is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, very long way to say no, it wouldn't have made a difference.
And then you wanted to discuss the changes, are they proposed changes to immigration and as far as birthright citizenship of military overseas?
Man, I tried to do a little bit more research on this subject to find out exactly what the exclusion principles were. And, I wasn't able to really track it down, but basically a new rule by the Department of Justice. It's the elimination of a very old rule. Some of you might remember that when John McCain ran for president, there were some who tried to question his eligibility to run because he was actually born on a military base outside the United States. But because he was born to American parents, it was as if he was born on American soil, and so he was eligible to run for president. The Department of Justice has now eliminated that rule. And so for some military families, and they have been very vague about which ones will be implicated, they will have to apply for citizenship for their children born abroad. It's no longer automatically granted to their kids. These are people who are serving abroad in our military, and when they come home, they will have to apply for citizenship for their children.
Like, what is this fucking swing at? Like, I understand the also from our little break where they wanted to boot out anybody that was trying to legally immigrate if they, at some point in time, they may become a ward of the state. And if they might go on food stamps at some point in time, then we're going to kick back their eligibility for legal immigration. And like, okay.
Oh, they went even further than that. They tried to remove protections for critically ill migrants who are undergoing life-saving care.
Oh, that was just recently.
Yeah, and they backed down on it today because everyone, even in their own party, went, what the fuck is wrong with you? We're trying to win an election in 2020, and you've got them showing pictures of little girls dying in wheelchairs that you're going to deport. What the fuck is your problem?
Is the idea just to be cruel at this point in time? Like, I don't understand why you would attack U.S. citizenship for military overseas that are defending or, you know, are serving this country. What, like, I can see how people would go along with these other attacks, you know, the most lowbrow of us. But I thought that they were all super big into the military. Like,
so
what is the game plan?
Here's my guess. Now, with part of this, we don't need to guess, right? The motivation behind this is it is an incremental step towards something that white supremacists have been trying to do for, like Donald Trump, have been trying to do for a long time, which is eliminate the principle of birthright citizenship, at least to eliminate certain aspects of it. Particularly, they want to eliminate the aspect of it where if you are born in the United States, you are a U.S. citizen.
Anchor babies.
Anchor babies. My guess, so they want to destabilize that principle of either, you know, you're born on U.S. soil or you're born to U.S. parents, you're a U.S. citizen, and make it more complicated so that maybe you have to, well, anyway, let's not get into what they want to replace it with. But let's talk about the fact that most likely this policy will be aimed exclusively at service members living abroad who have married local citizens. Right?
All right. Now it's starting to make sense.
It only makes sense because we know what kind of people are in this administration. It shouldn't make sense to anyone who lives in a civilized society. You know me. Everybody knows me. My position on our military today is it's a volunteer organization. All right? People go there to pursue a career. Now, it's still an adventurous thing to do. There's plenty to admire about it, but it doesn't, like, it's not the same as when we had a conscripted military. Nevertheless, why on earth would you do anything to punish the people that you depend upon to save you if you are invaded or threatened by another power?
It, to me, it just seems like when you show up for the fight and you want to prove how fucking crazy you are, you just turn and slap the shit out of your best friend.
It's got to be something like that.
It's like, we hate you fucking immigrants. You know how much we hate you fucking immigrants? Steve, get over here. Smack! That's how much. I like that guy. Imagine what I'm going to do to you.
It's entirely possible, man. Like, I just don't. I don't get it. It's the kind of ridiculously stupid own goal for you non-Americans out there listening. For you Americans, an own goal is when you kick the soccer ball into the net for your own team and score a point against yourself. That's an own goal.
What was the name of the guy? I want to say Brock Osweiler, but it wasn't him. But it was a name like Osweiler that played for the Lions, who ran out the back of the end zone on a pass play.
Yeah, that would be an own goal.
Yeah, if you know that guy's name, hit us up at Plastic Cut Pod on your favorite social media sites.
this administration is becoming known for these kinds of own goals, right? The saddest part about that is to its hardcore supporters, they aren't own goals. They consider these to be victories.
Yeah, it is like the crazy person, because I cannot fathom why they would do this attack. Like, it just doesn't make any sense.
Well, it's just, it's incrementalism at work, right? It's the same as, so we recently saw two ballot initiatives get, they went down in flames, I'm happy to report, both 105 and 106.
Is that a plastic cup politics push?
Yeah. So Prop 105 was the you know, let's kill light rail, which comes around every other, you know, every other election year, some typically some outside group. Although the time before this, it was actually Shamrock Foods that was the primary funder behind the anti-light rail campaign. Keep that in mind the next time you're out buying cheese. But this time it was pretty much the Koch brothers who were funding it. Well, Koch brother now. Haha, hope it hurt, fucker. 106 was the end pensions for politicians, man. Right? So 106 would have A, mandated that certain services couldn't be paid for until the pension fund was balanced. But at the same time, it would have eliminated pensions for elected officials. Now, why would they do that? Well, it's one step towards a goal that they have been striving for a long time. And it's an easy target because no one likes politicians, right? Fuck those guys. We can take their pensions away, right? So what about next time if it's bureaucrats? No one likes bureaucrats, right? Fuck those guys. Their pensions can go. And then the time after that, it's, well, look, let's
face it. And then they came after the gypsies, yeah. And I said nothing.
Yeah, it's incrementalism at its least competent, right? Because both efforts were super ham-handed, and that's largely why they went down in flames. That and the fact that people think it's reasonable that we should be able to pay for pensions and parks. It's just we have to discuss raising taxes in order to do it. But you have one side of the conversation that can no longer be taken seriously because they have determined that raising taxes is unacceptable under any circumstance. Right? They have become the very definition of extremists. They're basically economic jihadis, right? And you can't negotiate with terrorists.
Well, unless it's the Taliban.
Yeah, well, yeah, we've been negotiating like motherfuckers with them.
Okay, moving on. Sorry. Yep.
No, that's okay.
We do not negotiate with terrorists other than the Taliban. Moving on. Let's not forget that there was money for a border wall in exchange for DACA protections way back in the day. And then the White House decided, you know what? Let's go after legal immigration. And that's when that whole thing fell apart. So it's not like this is a new thing going after legal immigration, but it sucks. But you know what? We're not the only ones that have weird shit going on. Dr. Sean Hayes, what's going on with Brexit, man?
Holy shit, man. You remember how I said there's no way Boris Johnson prorogues Parliament? And for a refresher, prorogue means to close Parliament. Yeah, I was fucking wrong, dude. That guy's got a set of, well, I don't know if he's got a set of brass ones on. I think he's just fucking crazy, to be honest. Like, he's got the same goofy hair as Trump, right? And he's got the same sort of low cunning, but he also has the same, like, dementia and megalomania. So he went to the Queen and asked her to prorogue Parliament, to close Parliament for an extra week in September and an extra week in October, eliminating 2 weeks worth of negotiating time for Parliament to try and come up with legislation to block him from leaving the European Union without a deal, which he had vowed to do. So he went to the Queen and asked her, and the Queen, in an odd twist of logic, but an expected one, went ahead and approved it. And the reason she approved it is that it's been a long-standing tradition that the crown doesn't get involved in politics. Right? That's the trade-off. England continues to pay for the royal family to be the royal family, and the royal family stays out of politics. At least overtly. Covertly, they are very involved in politics. And for those of you out there who are like, why? That sounds like a lousy deal. Why do we keep paying for that? Blah, blah, blah. Or why would the English keep paying for that? Because the royal family and its estates bring in more money than any other industry in the United Kingdom. All right. Tourism, royal family tourism, and other royal family affiliated sales are a major industry in the United Kingdom. So, yes, they keep them around for good reason.
As is tradition.
But the Queen actually still has very real powers. She just chooses not to exercise them. Now, here's the problem. Here's why this logic's a little bit twisted. The second Boris Johnson came to her and said he wanted her to prorogue Parliament, he had already dragged the royal family into politics. By agreeing to prorogue Parliament, she involved herself in politics. The right answer would have been to say, I'm sorry, Mr. Johnson, you're going to have to negotiate with your colleagues in Parliament to resolve this issue. The Crown will not get involved.
Has there been pierogies before?
Yes, the Queen has prorogued Parliament before, and for a variety of reasons. I don't need to go down all of them here, but never for one like this.
Yeah, but none of those were political?
You know, I mean, like, some of them were pretty close to the goddamn line, but not like this. Not like this. Prorogation has not been used by a prime minister as a weapon against his own parliament before. No.
Yeah, we live in a society in a lifetime of never like this.
Yeah. Although that's only, you know, that's still only holding true in specific cases. In general, the world has seen cycles of turmoil like this before, and I think ultimately we'll weather it. It's just, on the individual basis, we are experiencing some firsts. And not all of them are good ones. But we experienced another first today, and it was a fucking great one, because you got to, if you enjoy this sort of shit, you could watch it happen on C-SPAN. And you could watch England's version of Donald Trump deflate as his own party severed his testicles. So, what happened was, Parliament came back to work today. They were on vacation for several weeks. So they came back into session, and the very first thing they did was they went to... I know I'm going to fuck this up, because they have titles in their parliament that are very similar to ours. So their House of Commons has both a Speaker of the House of Commons and a Chancellor of the House of Commons, maybe, or a Chair. Anyway, the Speaker of the House of Commons is a good pal of Boris Johnson. It's the other guy, the guy who sits in the giant chair at the end of Parliament, if you ever watch it on C-SPAN, and he has the funny wig on. It's that guy. And right now, his name is John Bercow. John Bercow is a dyed-in-the-wool English conservative, but not a fan of Boris Johnson and definitely not a fan of no-deal Brexit. So they said, hey, we want you to hold a vote for us to... It's funny the language they have for this, by the way. Like, it's literally to, I think, like, the name of the maneuver is to seize the docket or something. Or seize the daily agenda. That's what it is. Yeah. So they, and John Bercow said, okay, we'll hold that vote. And immediately Parliament voted to allow the minority party, the opposition, to seize the daily agenda. The opposition then immediately put forward legislation that states in no uncertain terms that if October 31st arrives and no deal has been reached, the prime minister will ask the EU for an extension. So they made illegal a no-deal Brexit.
But does the EU have to give them that extension?
No, but they will. So what's important to remember is that a no-deal Brexit will hurt the United Kingdom terribly. But it'll also kind of suck for the European Union.
And the United States and China and very much Ireland. Ooh, that, by the way, That was a question that I have going back to earlier. Where was the Pale as far as where Ireland and Northern Ireland are now?
Oh, it was nowhere near it. So it's a point of pride for the Irish, which I know back when I used to be Irish. It's an interesting story. The Pale, the English Pale, which is ultimately how the territory that the English in Ireland controlled came to be known. It was referred to as the English Pale. Encompassed maybe a third of the island, and it was the lower, like the southeastern third.
Okay, cool. I just knew that it had to be a place. I wanted to know where it was, and I knew we were going to get here.
Yeah.
Because that's one of the major issues, is a hard border in Ireland, which was, I don't know if you guys remember, 2 decades ago when there was all kinds of bad shit going on in Ireland, revolving around the border. Like, it's an open border now. People live on one side, work on the other. Kind of like San Antonio, but different.
Well, and so it's not just important for people who live around that border. It's also vital for the nation of Ireland as a whole. And for the province or the territory of Northern Ireland. And the reason why is that Ireland's primary deep water port is in Ulster. It's in Northern Ireland. So most of the goods and materials that get shipped to Ireland, and that's a lot. Ireland has a lot of manufacturing facilities that have opened up over the last 20 years as a result of some pretty aggressive tax incentives. Some of those shut down after the 2008 financial crisis, but it's still, Ireland does a lot of business. And a lot of that comes through Northern Ireland, and it has to come across the border into Ireland proper. If that border becomes a hard border overnight with no trade agreement in place, so no way to govern cross-border transactions, it essentially devastates the economy for both Ireland and Northern Ireland. Now, the Northern Irish faction is as insanely right-wing as the Ulster Orange have always been. And so they are actually like, they're one of the most solid parts of Boris Johnson's coalition government, despite the fact that hard Brexit will destroy the economy of Northern Ireland. We're talking about unemployment levels never seen in that region before, even during the Troubles. So it's like the whole situation there is just completely cockamamie. None of it makes any sense. But there was this one bright spot where, like, that legislation, the legislation that they put forward to stop a no-deal Brexit, passed overwhelmingly. And one of the major reasons that it did was that 21 members of the Conservative Party voted in favor and were subsequently expelled from the party by Boris Johnson and forbidden to run in subsequent general elections as a Conservative.
So are they free agents now?
Yeah, basically. And one of them, just to make absolutely clear how he felt about things, while Boris Johnson was speaking, stood up, and this is not some young firebrand. This is a dude in like his late 60s, early 70s, who has been a Conservative since he was in diapers, stood up while Boris Johnson was speaking on the floor of the House of Parliament, walked slowly and deliberately past him, across the aisle, and seated himself with the Liberal Democrats. Man, there's something to this whole, like, it's cool, you know, there's no press conference, or manicured press release saying, I have decided to switch my party allegiances for these reasons. No. You get the fuck up and you do it in front of everyone. You let everybody see you do it.
That's the McCain thumbs down.
Yeah, which was fucking awesome. God damn it. That was one of the moments that I loved that man more than at any time in the past. And, you know, I mean, I suppose that's not saying a whole lot because he and I didn't agree on much, but oh, that was a great moment. Sorry.
Were you ever unhappy, like, that he was your senator and that you didn't agree with him, but you were just like, God, why does that guy have to be from here?
Over Iraq, yeah.
Okay.
Now that shows you like how, look, if you're serious about self-governance and you're serious about America, if you're serious about democracy in this country, then you should experience swings in like passion about a single individual representative all the time. It should happen. So like simultaneously to me being, oh dude, why does McCain have to be from Arizona while he's pumping up the invasion of Iraq? He is also taking the administration to task for torture. And no one in Congress was better suited for that task than John McCain. And I couldn't have been more proud. So, you know, I mean, like, part of the problem is that we now live in a world where people have the ability to cultivate their ideological experience. And we have all created what we believe are highly individualistic microcultures, but are actually just carbon copies of the microcultures created by all the people around us that we're associating with, right? All we're doing is sort of bubbling together. We're not actually creating anything unique in our little space. And it's that monochromatic political experience that we have these days that is part of what's killing democracy in this country. It's part of why, like I said the last time we talked, we all need to very seriously think about getting behind this effort by the state's attorneys general. And yes, that is the proper way to pronounce that, state's attorneys general, to investigate big tech on antitrust grounds. See, I brought that motherfucker back around.
Okay, yeah. Yes, you did. Nice work. Because I was just kind of thinking about it, about how I know I did vote for John McCain before, and I know that I voted against John McCain. And, you know, of course I knew John McCain was going to win. And when he did, it was like, all right, that's fine. As opposed to now with, like, Paul Gosar, where I'm like, how the fuck can anybody that's around me vote for this guy? Like, that is not at all the way that I feel about John McCain. Like, I feel like they're kind of flip-flopped. Like, the things that John McCain did that really upset me are, like, the amount of things that Paul Gosar posts about how, like, Arizona breweries are a giant drive to the economy. Like, yes, that is true, Paul Gosar. Good job. I think we need to go to war in Iraq. It's like, ah, how, damn it. John McCain, you shouldn't have done that one thing.
Yeah.
They're kind of that far out of whack, even though, you know, I'm sure that politically, you know, on a lot of things, they probably saw eye to eye. It's just there's so much seems to be more jackassery around. Like, you have to make a name for yourself. And it seems like the way that John McCain made a name for himself, whether you disagree with him or not, was honorable, as opposed to the Joe Arpaios of this world, who is running for fucking sheriff again. Then there's the Arpaios of the world, which I think Gosar is as well, which is, how can I get my name in the news and how can I get another Breitbart article, which he just has a new one. I didn't read it, but, you know, how can I become famous for being one of the worst people, as opposed to being, you know, is this the Kardashian effect?
Yeah. More or less. You know, what's hilarious about the sheriff joke thing is I'm fairly certain he's not eligible.
Has anybody
convicted told
him?
Criminal.
He was pardoned.
But that's what most people don't understand. A pardon requires allocution. What you are doing when you get a pardon is you are signing a document that says, yes, indeed, I am guilty of what I did. but I am accepting this presidential pardon. Someone pointed it out to him live on TV. You can go and look up the clip where someone confronts him with the fact that by accepting the pardon, he pled guilty. He's a convicted criminal.
You can't be a convicted criminal and be sheriff?
I don't think you can. I could be wrong.
Because I really haven't heard that argument. Like, I really feel like I should have heard that argument before. And I do remember, I know the interview that you're talking about, because the interview that you were talking about was months ago.
Yeah.
And he just came out running for sheriff recently, and I haven't seen anything about how he couldn't. And I feel like I would have. But
we can look it up.
We will look that up, or you can look that up. You can get back to us at Plastic Cup Pod. Yeah, all your favorite social media sites. How about that? So you've given us the worst case scenario, when to be upset and get your panties in a bunch about Brexit. So this vote today that says that they cannot crash out, like that's a binding vote in the House of Commons or whatever, like that shit's law.
It is, okay. With a caveat.
Of course.
Of course. So what Boris will now do, and he has telegraphed this by saying that he absolutely will never ask the EU for an extension. He is legally required by this parliament to do so because of the legislation they passed. He's going to call a snap general election. He's going to schedule it for October 14th, which is about 2 weeks before the October 31st deadline. He is counting on an influx of angry pro-Brexit far-right voters to give him just enough of a percentage to form a government. And he will then take that as a mandate to do a no-deal Brexit. The more likely outcome at this point, based on the polling in the UK, is that he is going to get trounced, and badly, in particular because there are a significant number of conservatives who he just expelled from the party, but who will most likely still run for their seats and probably successfully. And there are other conservatives who have already indicated that they are going to leave the party in coming days. Combine that with sort of just a general public revulsion at what he's done since he's gotten in office, and a general disaffection with the idea of Brexit altogether. Most people in the UK these days are not fond of the idea anymore now that they have been faced with the most likely consequences. So he's going to call a general election. If he loses, then the leader of the opposition party, Jeremy Corbyn, who would be the most likely one to form a majority government if Boris Johnson loses, will then go to the EU and ask them for an extension. The EU will absolutely grant it. And then he will use that to either call a new referendum and allow the public to vote again on whether they really want to leave the EU, or to negotiate a real separation agreement for the UK to leave, but to do it in a more orderly fashion and hopefully with a better chance of actual passage. But either way, that vote is binding for now, but there are complications. He's going to call an election. The interesting thing is, in order to get his snap general election, 2/3 of Parliament has to vote in favor. The opposition leader, who currently controls, you know, something like 22% of the seats in Parliament, has said at this point, he's not going to vote in favor. So we're now faced with the possibility that Boris Johnson will call a snap election, Parliament will vote and vote no, and then we're stuck with, okay, so now the Prime Minister has vowed that he will never do what Parliament just ordered him to do. What happens? We are back in uncharted waters.
A constitutional crisis?
Yes, a constitutional crisis for the country with an unwritten constitution.
I guess it comes down to this. Do you feel better tonight I should have said this earlier, September 3rd, 2019, than you did 3 weeks ago when we recorded about what's going on with Brexit.
Yes. Now, that's not to say that I feel any more optimistic that Brexit will not happen, but I feel more optimistic about, I suppose, politics in general, by virtue of the fact that we've had a couple of examples in the last week or two, today in the UK and last week in Italy, of a democratic public turning to its leaders and going, no, you know, by virtue of their representatives, right? It wasn't necessarily the public itself that stood up and said no, although plenty of them had. They relied upon their representatives, which is what we do in a representative democracy, which is the kind of government that we live in, to make that right call for them, and they did, and it worked. That should give hope to all of us who are somewhat concerned, and rightfully so, that when he loses in 2020, the orange one will refuse to leave. And then we have to depend upon Congress to act vigorously to defend the Republic. I feel better tonight about that potential outcome than I did 3 weeks ago.
I think that might be a podcast, my friend.
Sounds good to me.
All right. How about that? Thank you guys for listening in. If you enjoyed the show, you can go ahead and subscribe. However you're listening to this, seems like a good idea. You can interact with the show at Plastic Cup Pod on all your favorite social media sites. And I guess that's it, man. Have a good night. We'll talk to you guys again next week, right?
Yep.
All right.